Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Here's your host, Zach Gelb.
Yes, we're coming to you live from the Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans Studios. Home is more than a house. It's a personal paradise. Get yours with Rocket Mortgage. Push button. Get mortgage. One thing to carry over from the last hour as we were discussing this James Corden situation is we did find out today that Carpool Karaoke, where you have James Corden singing with legendary singers, and they have all the songs going together, and Corden is singing the lyrics that like a Stevie Wonder song would be, and Stevie Wonder will be singing the song back to him. And we found out today that someone posted that pretty much the Corden Mobile is on training wheels, and they have someone rolling the car along in front of him and dragging the car along. So I was very upset about that when we found out about that, and we talked about that in the last segment. Brian Jackson, who's a Twitter user, he said, you mean to tell me people saw the Stevie Wonder episode where he does the carpool karaoke with Stevie Wonder, and specifically this part, and post the photo where Corden and Stevie Wonder switch places and didn't question if they were actually driving or not? That's very fair. And I even said there were some points where you think, yeah, maybe they're not driving. Yeah, that's the dead giveaway when Stevie Wonder is in the driver's seat and nothing happened to the car. I'm very disappointed. I'm heartbroken. I'm crushed over this. And I just wonder, what are we going to find out next in the TV world in regards to cars and people driving them and TV shows that maybe they're not actually driving the vehicle while doing something awesome? You know, New York City, that you ever watch that Cash Cab? You guys ever seen Cash Cab? You never seen Cash Cab, Mikey B?
No.
Wow? Really?
Sounds familiar, but I've not seen it.
Tom, you seen Cash Cab?
Oh, yeah. Weird show.
So Cash Cab, you have a taxi cab driver, and it's a game show in the taxi cab. And let's say if the trip is 25 minutes, you get asked all these questions. You could win different levels, different increments of money. And then there's like a red light challenge when you get to a red light. If you get three questions wrong, you get a free cab ride, but you get booted at the place that you are when you get your third question wrong. And then at the end, they always do, you could take the money and go, or you get a mystery question. I think it doubles down whatever money you have in the pot. We're going to find out next that the guy in Cash Cab isn't actually driving the car. If that's the case, that will really crush my dreams, my aspirations, my heart and soul in terms of any confidence with television. Talk about television, too. You guys watched the Aaron Hernandez documentary.
I did, yeah.
I have not seen it yet, no.
Okay. I actually did the whole thing in one shot yesterday.
Wow, that's impressive. It's 3 hours long. Yeah. A little 3 hours and change.
Yeah.
I did the first episode last night, the second episode this morning, and I think I'm going to watch the third one tonight. There's something that I never knew about the case, and I saw, I think it was the Oxygen special that they did, which I didn't love the Oxygen special. If memory serves me right, it was produced by one of his attorneys that was in there with Tiki and Tierney, the attorney that represented Casey Anthony. Yeah,
yes.
Jose Baez. And they had this whole buildup in the Oxygen special of Aaron Hernandez and his fiance, and how they had the fiance remove the bag that may or may not have the gun in the bag, which he just asked her to go in the basement. You see the video of him walking around after the shooting, and he has the gun. And then he goes into the basement, and then a few days later, they ask her to remove the trash bag, and it was a heavy trash bag. So that one that I hated in that documentary, in the Oxygen documentary, they make this whole buildup, and then they pretty much let her off the hook in terms of the explanation. So I never liked that one. This documentary, from what I've seen so far in the first two episodes, and I still have one more to go, I think it's more fair, let me just say, Clearly, they do talk about his sexuality and how he was in the closet for years and years and years. And that's been talked about. And some people do believe the reason why he killed Olden Lloyd is that Olden Lloyd knew that he was gay and he didn't want that to come out and all that. And you have the two things I learned from this, really. You have his high school quarterback, and they were talking about how they grew up as friends, and they would experiment with each other, is the way that they phrase it in the documentary. And there was a romantic relationship with the two while they were in high school. And the other thing that I never knew, and I knew his father died, and a lot of people believe that did work its way into Aaron Hernandez really going off the rails and turning into this miserable, awful human being that we know that Aaron Hernandez was. And I used to love Aaron Hernandez when he was a football player. He was such a fun football player. You're a Gators fan, so you probably loved him more than anybody.
Yeah.
And I've never done a complete 180 on someone and go from loving a player to absolutely hating a player overnight when you found out that he was arrested in the murders that did happen. I know one he was convicted of, the other one, overturned? Not overturned. He was found not guilty.
Yeah, he was acquitted on the one that was a double murder, the shooting.
That was the word I was looking for. Yeah,
drive-by.
Yeah, with the drive-by, which who knows what's true or not. When that vehicle is in his cousin's house in that documentary that you find out the other day.
Yep.
Yeah, he may have got acquitted. Doesn't mean in my books that he's innocent.
It means Baez did a very good job in that case.
Yeah, bingo. But in this new documentary, I never knew that after when his father died, his cousin who was married, her husband ends up dating Hernandez's mother.
Within 3 months.
First off, your husband just died. I understand everyone mourns and grieves differently. Why would you ever date your cousin's husband? Someone that Aaron was very close to, the wife of that husband.
Yeah, his closest family member besides his parents and his siblings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she held some secrets. She went to jail for him when she had cancer.
Yeah. She refused to say anything ever.
So that documentary so far has been wild, the first two episodes. And the father of the quarterback that Hernandez had a romantic relationship when they were in high school, the father, I think, is the star of the documentary. When he talks about how that relationship where Terry Hernandez starts dating the cousin's husband, and he starts talking about the last thing you want as a kid is to see some guy in his boxers cooking bacon and sleeping in your dead father's bed. That guy, he's a character, and you think like he's playing up his role, but he's also serious when he's saying that. So Hernandez had a messed up upbringing. The father was abusive. The mother, how she could do that after losing her husband is absolutely gross. And then we eventually know he was going to go to UConn, then he goes to Florida. And then a lot of bad things happened in his life. I don't have sympathy for Aaron Hernandez. I've said that for years. People try to play the sympathy card in Aaron Hernandez. That is an evil, awful, disgusting individual. I know people talk about how he had the most severe case of CTE ever. That is probably the only part that I have sympathy for with Aaron Hernandez. With that being said, though, it doesn't excuse what he did. It doesn't, in my book, excuse what he did whatsoever. So is the episode 3, does anything crazy happen at episode 3 that tops episode 1 and 2?
Just I'm not sure if you've seen the conversation between him and his mother, Terry, yet, where he basically blames her for messing
yes,
him up.
Yes, I think that was in season 2.
Yeah, so
he said he was an innocent angel, and then she did some bleeped up things, and that totally messed him up.
They did a very good job showing that the father, even though he was abusive, gave structure. He also died suddenly from a routine, like I think it was a hernia operation.
Yeah, it was a hernia.
It wasn't like he had cancer, was sick for an extended period of time. Like, it happened on a routine surgery, and he was gone, just like that. And then 3 months later, she's living with this other guy who moved into the house. So they did a good job of showing how, like, the absence of structure caused him to kind of fall apart. And then the other thing, you'll get more about the concussions in part three.
Sure.
But the other thing they mentioned, I believe, in part one that I never knew before that I think is important, at least to the whole CTE thread, mm-hmm. is that he had an incident in high school where he was knocked out cold on the field.
Yes, yes.
And had to be removed by an ambulance.
Yes.
And I never knew that. And that,
no,
you know,
neither did I.
That's relevant information to this whole entire saga.
It is, and we don't totally know everything there is to know about CTE. Obviously, we don't know every. You can't diagnose it in someone until they're dead. I remember talking at the Super Bowl a few years ago to a doctor. They think they're coming closer to actually being able to diagnose it when people are alive. And clearly, it has an effect on your life in a big way. And could it attribute possibly to some of the violent outbursts? Yes, it still doesn't fully excuse
of course not.
The decision-making he made in terms of keeping on going back and keep on going back to people that he should not have been associating himself with.
At the same time, you see, of course I agree with that, but you see there's all these witnesses from his youth that talked about how happy and what an amazing person he was, what a self-deprecating, non-violent
sure.
person he was, and then this weird change happened between the time he was 18 and when he died at 27. They said it was the worst case of CTE in a 27-year-old that science has ever found.
The other wild part, too, is, and they showed it a little bit in the documentary, but they don't do a great job in capturing it. They did a better job in the oxygen one on this part only. When he was going to the facility, when all these rumors were being talked about and he was in the news, how he was being investigated, and they said at first he wasn't the person of interest, but there's investigation and part of the whole story. He drove to the Patriots facility expecting to just show up to work, and his fiance, Shayana Jenkins, had the night before, I guess, driven the vehicle, and she didn't fill it up with gas. So he's going to the facility. Kraft says, you got to get out of here. He goes home. And they're chasing him as if it's the white Bronco, and everyone has a helicopter, and all these media people are following him.
It's a white truck, too.
And yeah. He has to stop for gas.
Yep.
And that's the photo of all the media people around him when he's filling up his tank of gas. The other thing I did love, though, on this one, are the phone calls when he's in prison.
Yeah. Chilling.
How he could be at times, and sometimes you could tell he's wacky, and sometimes you could tell he's clearly annoyed to be in there. And there's other times he's making jokes. He made a joke. This is where he's a real sick and twisted individual. He's making a joke with his agent about getting a sponsorship with a gun company.
Yeah.
When he's in there for shootings. And even the agent in there, he was laughing, and it was not a jovial laugh. It was a nervous laugh.
No, he calls him an F-bomb. After he said that Nike, he's trying to work on deals with Nike, and Nike told him that it's hard to put swooshes on orange jumpsuits, and that's his response. You should go to Smith & Wesson and ask them if they want a sponsorship
weird.
Deal.
Very, very
well, he
weird.
He bragged in these phone calls about how comfortable he was in prison,
mm-hmm.
which is
and he said he adapted
insane.
Pretty easily.
Yeah, instantly. He went from a mansion in North Attleboro, wherever it is, to a prison cell with no issues at all.
Wild. And also the other one, when the friend calls him, one of his childhood friends calls him, and they go, oh, sorry, we're watching the game. And he goes, I don't want to bring up any bad memories, trigger any bad memories. And he goes, I don't know, they were good memories. Crazy. How that guy was able to show up to work as if nothing was wrong, and was able to play football and had this big smile, and he was a football player by day and a killer at night.
Did they get into the second apartment yet, or is that part three? You might be watching. I don't want to spoil it.
The second apartment?
Yeah, okay, we'll talk about it tomorrow night
gotcha.
When you watch this third part.
Yeah.
I think this is the part where it gets bad for the Patriots, but I don't. Mm-hmm. Let's not get ahead of that yet.
Gotcha. Well, here's the. Do you put a lot of blame on the Patriots?
You
got to
see this part of it.
Yeah? Well, yeah. How do you put blame on an organ? The one, and I guess we have to see the whole thing. And this goes back to the leagues and mental health like we were talking about the other day. You can't hold the hand of your athlete 24/7.
Oh, no, I agree. And I'm not saying I do blame the Patriots or even that they get a percentage of the blame. It just gets muddy with how they react to finding out that he's going through. They know he's going through something, and the way they choose to handle it is just...
Yeah, I'll have to see it.
It's shady,
I'll have to see it before I comment. Also, though... It's a, you know, you get him in the fourth round. I couldn't knock any team for picking him in the fourth round. This was a first round talent. And you get him in the fourth round. So that was a signal that something was going wrong, especially when they had the private investigators and his social, what was it? The social,
his social like interactions or something graded the lowest they've ever seen or something. I forget exactly what the terminology was, but this goes from a guy who had it all. He had it all. Just had a baby, was about to get married, signed that four-year contract, whatever it was, for $40 million. I think it was five years. $40 million, and he gave it all up. Gave it all up. And the other, really, another, there's so many interesting parts in this documentary. You get hooked by it. Is the Lloyd friend, who is the other football player. I'm assuming.
Semi-pro football player.
He's in jail, right, this guy?
Is that right? I missed that detail.
I don't know if he's in jail, but when they show him, he looks like he's in jail just by the setting.
Yeah, it's a very drab backdrop.
It looks like he's in a 10x8 prison cell.
I don't think so.
Cell. I don't know if he is. At least that's the way, just as a viewer, I wondered if this guy was in jail, because they show him in a real dark background and it kind of looks like a prison cell. I don't know if he is. And the way he speaks, he doesn't come off as someone that is currently in prison, because he's making it clear you're either a football player or a gangster, he says. And Hernandez was a football player who was a wannabe gangster. That's the way that guy said it. But the relationship with the football team and that semi-pro football team that they have is such a fascinating bond. And how the guy, whoever the guy is that was Lloyd's teammate, said, if he was with us, none of this would have happened. Because we would have made him pick being a gangster or being a football player. I wonder, though, if that guy was in jail. Because when I was watching, it did cross my mind, is that guy in jail? Because it's a real dark background, or it's a white background. It looks like just a blank background is what I should say. And it kind of has that jail feel to it.
I get what you're saying. The guy has it together, though. He has some of the best testimonial in
he
the entire documentary. Yeah, he really explains it very well. And it's part of his deep frustration that his best friend was killed by this wannabe gangster when the two of them... See, the thing is, Hernandez came up in a perfectly middle-class suburban setting.
Yeah, that's
he didn't come from the hood. But these two guys did. They survived the hood as best friends, only for one of them to get murdered by a football player who wanted to act like a gangster.
Yeah, and some of the videos where he's just, before he kills Lloyd, he's just walking around, and he's clearly high, and he's the blue bubblicious bubble gum that becomes a big center of it. How sloppy of a crime it was, too. He returns a rent-a-car with the bullet casings there.
Still in it. Rented to his name with bullets in the car when he brings it back to Enterprise.
The thing, though, that made my jaw drop the most was when they go to the cousin's house and they find the car from the murder of the
Another double murder. Yeah, that went unsolved and drove the Boston police crazy that they couldn't get a lead on this. And all of a sudden, bang, here's the car in the Hernandez cousin's garage.
20 after the hour, it's the Zach Gelb Show.
You're listening to the Zach Gelb Show. He's glad you're still here. Now back to the Zach Gelb Show.
Zach Gelb Show on CBS Sports Radio. Coming up in 15 minutes, we'll chat a little football, chat a little Andy Reid, San Francisco 49ers, and Super Bowl memories with Dick Vermeil. You know, Dick Vermeil, we talk about McNabb and puking in the Super Bowl and if it happened or if it didn't happen. There's always something when you lose a Super Bowl. Sometimes there's something legitimate that people freak out about. For example, in 28-3, hadn't they run the football more after the Julio Jones catch? And then you get things that may be true, may be made up, with Donovan McNabb and the puking in that Super Bowl. In 1980, that Super Bowl with the Eagles and the Raiders, after the game, Vermeil was crushed. And like years after the game, that he was too strict on his players, where the Raiders players were allowed to go out until whenever, and Vermeil had his Eagles players on a strict bedtime limit. And I've talked to Vermeil about that before, and he thinks that anytime some team loses in the big game, some type of excuse is made up or something tries to take away, or there's some type of explanation
that people try to create and a reasoning that people try to create in order to say, okay, let's blame it on one individual or one person, where in reality, it's pretty tough to do. Is even if you want to look back at that NFC title game from last year, everyone looks back and says, oh, it was that one no call. Sure, if they make that call there, the game's over. However, the play calling by Sean Payton on that drive leading up to that phantom no call, I don't want to diminish the no call because it was an egregious no call. It was as bad could get of missed calls. If you don't think it's pass interference, there's like helmet-to-helmet contact or necessary roughness, whatever it was. But still, with that being said, they still got the ball back in overtime and breezed through an interception. I'm not saying it makes you feel better. I'm not saying Saints fans should say necessarily that. I don't ever believe, though, one call, one play, one no call, one play totally is the reason why you lose. Could be a huge factor. That's how we'll phrase it. Huge factor. And there's no doubt about it. Last year was a huge factor in the loss for the Saints. They still had a chance at redemption. However, what people would argue, you had victory and they snatched the victory away from you with that no call. So the excuses and it wasn't Vermeil obviously making those excuses, but what people try to make after a team loses really always stick out in your mind and things that you remember and get associated with the Super Bowl and how they just develop over time and the theories that end up getting passed on. If you want to look back, Super Bowl 49, people believe that Pete Carroll didn't hand the football off to Marshawn Lynch in that game and that spot because he didn't want Marshawn Lynch to get the MVP. I don't know how that rumor started. I don't know who started that rumor. Think about how crazy that is. You think Daryl Bevel and Pete Carroll, when they're deciding, oh, we're going to try to figure out what we're going to do on this play call, they're going to say on a play clock situation when the time is working against them, all right, we got this play, that play, this play, that play. All right, if we run play A, it's going to get Russell Wilson the Super Bowl MVP. If we run play B, it's going to get Marshawn Lynch the Super Bowl MVP. If we run play C, it's going to get this player the Super Bowl MVP. Absolutely not. That is one of them. That certain call, that decision to not hand the ball to Lynch, how many different theories you hear still to this day is absolutely amazing. And the aftermath of that one, that team would have won back-to-back Super Bowls. And won back-to-back titles where they would have defeated Peyton Manning and then Tom Brady. Think about that, what that accomplishment would have been. Even so, you could go back and look at that game and say, even clearly, though, they should have run the football. And we had Cliff Averill on first week of the show, and Cliff said we were in those decisions. He later learned they were in those situations earlier in the season, and they threw the football. So that's where ultimately you never let that go, but that's how you kind of sit at peace with the situation, just that one time, it wasn't executed. In that situation or that game, I don't think that was the only decision on why they lost. They still blew a 10-point lead with one of the great defenses you'll ever see in the fourth quarter. And you could also play the game that at that ridiculous, fortuitous bounce that they got down the sideline on what was that crazy catch by Curse. If that doesn't happen, they're not in that spot. And that saves Daryl Bevel and Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson for years and years of embarrassment. It's actually pretty cool, though, how the Seahawks were able to put that behind them. And it got ugly. Don't get me wrong. But now looking back at it, where we are now in 2020, they were able to totally change that roster, change that team. So many people did come and go in that organization. Carroll and Wilson do remain. And look what they're still doing now. Who would have thought the Seahawks were a playoff team last year? Who would have thought they would have been a dominant team this year? And at times they were a dominant team. Now, I thought it was fair going into this football season and thinking, okay, maybe the Seahawks do regress. Especially when you look at that offense and you were saying, who is Russell Wilson going to be throwing the football to? And DK Metcalf, or as Booger McFarland would say, DK Metcalf, He really stepped up and played exceptionally well. You also had Lockett, who had a good year the year before, really blossom and emerge. And you see what Russell Wilson could do and how he puts the team on his back and he finds a way to make Jacob Hollister even having productive moments as a tight end. And that's not a good offensive line that they have. That was an offensive line that was also decimated at times in the season with injuries, with guys missing games here and there for long stretches too. And the run game's helped now. And then that run game got hurt. That team was rolling. When that team had that victory up against the 49ers, you really thought that they could be a Super Bowl team if they were in the postseason with Penny and Carson and then both got hurt. It was unfortunate. And that defense needs to get better. They still haven't fully fixed that defense. But to make the playoffs the last 2 years with all the changes and to be able to overcome from where they were and to lose all those pieces and still step up and deliver, it is pretty impressive. Zach Gelb Show right here on CBS Sports Radio. When we come back, we'll be joined by Dick Vermeil. You don't want to miss that.
You're listening to the Zach Gelb Show.
Hey, this is Howie.
And this is Nick
from the Backstreet Boys.
And you're listening to the Zach Gelb Show on CBS Sports Radio. And guess what?
Zach is back. All right.
He's live. He's nationwide on CBS Sports Radio. This is the Zach Gelb Show.
It is the Zach Gelb Show right here on CBS Sports Radio. We continue to get you set for Super Bowl 54 next week between the San Francisco 49ers and the Kansas City Chiefs. Right now, we welcome in a former head coach of the National Football League, did coach in Kansas City, also had a stop with the St. Louis Rams where he did win a Super Bowl and also did lead the Philadelphia Eagles to a Super Bowl as well back in 1980. And that's Dick Vermeil, part of now Vermeil Wines, here with us on CBS Sports Radio. Coach, been a while. Thanks for the time. And how you been?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Yeah, I'm getting old, but I'm doing fine. Unfortunately.
I'm sure you're still sipping the wine, though. Wine is always good.
You bet.
So what's the latest with Vermeil Wines, by the way, Coach?
Well, you know, we're making 2,500 cases of wine, and our reds are now starting to get mid-90 grades and everything. Our winemaker, Thomas Brown, and Andy Jones just does an outstanding job. I just spent 3 days out there last week working it. And it's in our 2017s will be released in February, and then our 2018s are in the barrel, and they look like they're going to be the best we've ever made. So it's going well. We still haven't made the playoffs, though.
Dick Vermeil here with us on CBS Sports Radio. Now, a little birdie also told me that earlier in the week or last week you were doing some hunting. You're still hunting, Coach?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was hunting with Keith Kreflin, my tight end on my Eagle team, and my inside linebacker, Frank LeMaster. We spent a whole day hunting released birds, pheasants, you know, one of the big old farms in central Pennsylvania. You had a great time.
Did you catch anything?
Oh, you bet. We don't catch them. We shoot them.
Coach Vermeil here with us. Hey, you know, this is the time of the year where everyone looks back at the Super Bowl memories and the lead-up to the game. You know what it is next week, the zoo down at Radio Row. When you look back at Super Bowl 34, what are the memories still to this day that stand out to you, Coach?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is I see Isaac Bruce run down the sideline and go one-on-one and catch a touchdown pass. It puts us up in the ball game, you know. I was standing right there, and off he took, you know, took off he went, and then wham, the curtain hit him, underthrew him just a little bit, and he dipped back, got the ball. Ozakim came down the field, got a brush block, and off he went in for the score. Then I remember looking down there to try to find out if Tennessee scored on the last play or not. I couldn't tell from where I was standing, but when I saw that the officials didn't raise their hand signaling touchdown, I knew that we won the game.
How long did it take to sink in? Like, in that moment, do you realize you won the Super Bowl, or does it take a little bit for you to realize the importance of what your team was able to accomplish?
Well, you know, I remember throwing my arms up in the air and saying, we are world champions, something like that. You know, I remember that like it was yesterday. And then the exhilaration starts. Then all the different variations of emotion start gripping you, and you start thinking about a lot of different things. But number one, you feel very fortunate to have had the opportunity to coach with the coaches I had and coach those players. You know, players win games, not coaches.
What was the party like after that victory? Just wondering, Coach.
Long.
I'm assuming you didn't get much sleep, right?
Yeah, you know what I remember a lot about it is seeing the parents of the players in the party and sitting around a table sipping on a cold beer or something like that with moms and dads of these fine kids that I had the opportunity to be with for 3 years and through that season. So, you know, it's amazing how events like that draw people together.
Dick Vermeil here with us on the Zach Gilb Show on CBS Sports Radio. Hey, you mentioned Isaac Bruce. He's now up for the Hall of Fame as a finalist for the fourth time. Torrey Holt is up for the Hall of Fame as well for the first time as a finalist. When you look back, those two players, we all know that they're great players. They deserve a place in Canton, Ohio. They're now in the waiting game of will they get in or when will they get in. What would you have to say about Isaac Bruce and Torrey Holt if you had to give them a little endorsement for the Hall?
Well, first off, they are both Hall of Fame quality wide receivers. You know, when it's all said and done, we will have five offensive players in the Hall of Fame off that one team. And what I'm really proud of is we brought, in our 3 years there working together, we brought four of them there. Isaac was there. All we had to do was surround him with people that could help him be what he had the ability to be, starting with Kurt Warner. So, you know, it's just an unbelievable experience. You'll never forget it. But I'll tell you this. I think about my losing Eagle team in the Super Bowl every bit as much because they did more and worked harder longer to get there and lose than my winning team did to get there and win. We just didn't go with five Hall of Famers or a coach good enough to get it done.
When you go from that first Super Bowl in 1980 against the Raiders and then back in 99 against Tennessee, how did you change as a coach? Did that previous experience in 1980 help you the second time around, going through it another time as a head coach?
You know, it did. I had a perspective of what it's going to be like. The only thing was different. The first time we went, we had a two-week bye. You know, we had the bye. The second time, the St. Louis Ram Tennessee game, we didn't have a bye. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Monday after winning the NFC Championship, we were on a plane flying to Atlanta. So it really made that week hectic. Maybe I didn't have time to screw it up, and that's why we won. I don't know. But it was very hectic, and it was a real disadvantage to all the families involved because you couldn't start buying airline tickets and make a hotel reservation if you didn't know you weren't going to the game, you know.
When you were in the Super Bowl, how many people that you didn't hear from in a long time start to reach out to you to try to see if they could, if you could get them a ticket to the game?
You know, not many, because you know, as the head coach, you're sheltered, you know, and especially the way we were, we didn't have a day off. We were on the plane going. In fact, I left my entire coaching staff in St. Louis, and then flew them in Wednesday morning so they could prepare Monday and Tuesday just as if we were playing a home game in the regular season. And I think it helped our preparation.
A few more with Dick Vermeil, who's here with us right now on CBS Sports Radio. Coach, when we get to Andy Reid, I know that you know him well. Going back with his time in Philadelphia, you coached the Eagles too, and then your time with Kansas City, now him being the Kansas City Chiefs coach as well, so there is that connection. Andy's been around a long time. The one thing missing off his resume is that Super Bowl trophy and getting that ring on his finger. If he's able to get the job done next Sunday, what would that mean for you to see Andy Reid finally get that Super Bowl victory?
Well, you know, I kind of believe I represent all the experienced NFL head coaches and those that are retired that have coached against Andy. I think we would all like to see him win one. Now, that doesn't mean we're against Kyle Shanahan. He's done a marvelous job. But he's going to be in the league a lot longer, as he's already proved he has the ability to do it. And he'll win one if he doesn't win this one somewhere down the road and maybe more. But I'll tell you, as your career, you know, you get a little long in the tooth, you know, and you don't know how much longer you're going to coach. I think if you start with the best coach in this league, Bill Belichick, and work right on down through us peons, you're going to find out that we're all pulling for Andy to win one for the right reasons.
Yeah, and there's no doubt about that. Hey, your Rams team in 99 and what this Chiefs offense is able to do this year, do you see any comparisons? Just wondering, because what they've done the last 2 weeks, going down 24-0 and coming back like it's nothing, 17-7, coming back
like it's nothing. It's really something, Coach.
Yeah, no question. I don't recommend they do that this next week against the 49ers. But anyway, yeah, it's amazing. We had a very, very explosive offense, just like this is. I think they are probably maybe even a little bit better. I don't know. They don't have Marshall Faulk in the backfield that we had. Okay, that makes a difference. They don't have a Hall of Fame left tackle we had in Orlando Pace, those kind of things, you know. And they don't have an 18-sack guy in Kevin Carter. So we had some physical advantages. But when you add the talent they had, the talent that Andy Reid has with his own coaching skills and his coaching staff, they'd probably kick my butt.
When you have an offense like that, you probably never thought you were going to lose, right?
Well, we weren't counting on it. I tell you, I've never gone into a big game in my life like I felt going into that one. I just knew we were going to win the game, and it came right down to the last play. So that shows you how good a judgment I have. But anyway, thank heavens for Mike Jones making the tackle.
You're probably still sending some bottles of Vermeil wine, right?
You bet. Yeah, you bet. No, Mike Jones is coaching high school football in St. Louis.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool. See, that's got to be awesome for you all these years later to see what your players now do in the next stage of their life, all these years removed from the game. That's got to be neat as a coach, right?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. You always have a few disappointing
things
that you wish you could do more to help them do more. But overall, I'm very proud of them on and off the field.
Well, hey, Coach, it's always great to catch up with you. We do appreciate a few minutes. Best of luck, and we'll catch up soon. Thank you.
Take care. Go Chiefs.
Appreciate Dick Vermeil joining us right there on CBS Sports Radio. It is the Zach Gelb Show. Let me remind you that CBS Sports Radio's toll-free line is 855-212-4227, and it's sponsored by GEICO. Whether you own or rent, GEICO makes it easy to bundle home and auto insurance. Having a home is hard work, so get a quote at geico.com. Easy. One more thing before we get on out of here. As we're approaching the top of the hour, Andy Gresh is going to be entertaining many of the same CBS Sports Radio affiliates, Sirius XM Channel 206, and the radio.com application in about 9 minutes. We were talking about this Hernandez documentary. So the guy that is the friend of Odin Lloyd, the other semi-pro football player, his name is Mike Macy, something like that. I went to his Twitter page. It says, yoga saved my life. Now I use yoga to save lives. So, when I was watching that for a second, it crossed my mind. And I go, is this guy in prison right now? Because they have that white background. It looks like he's in a small room. He has this white T-shirt on. It maybe looks like a jumpsuit. And I'm sitting there thinking, this guy is just so real in the entire piece. The line that he gives, I found the quote. It's the most vile gangsters in these new, not to bleep with us, because we were football players. And it's so ironic that a bleeping football player that wanted to be a fake bleeping gangster killed my boy. That's the line of the documentary. I encourage a lot of people to watch this Hernandez piece. The Oxygen one was okay. It was extremely biased in it. This one, I thought, did a very good job in just refreshing and showing the story and getting all the sides of it. And then all the telephone calls in jail was neat information that I've not heard of before. But I still can't get my head over his mom after the father dies. And D-Ben, you said, what was it, 3 months?
3 months later.
3 months later is dating the closest relative that Hernandez had, his cousin, her husband. While I'm watching that, I'm saying, man, what is wrong with Terry Hernandez? So it's always a wild story, something like we've never seen, obviously, and hopefully you never see anything like it again. Once again, I don't have sympathy for Hernandez. That was some guy I used to love rooting for, and what he did is an absolute monster, absolutely sickening. As well. All right, fun show today. I'd like to thank Colin Dunlap for joining us from 937 The Fan in Pittsburgh. You just heard Dick Vermeil a few moments ago. I'd like to thank the coach as well. Also like to thank each and every one of you for calling, listening, and tweeting and participating in the show. We'll be back tomorrow on a big Friday edition of the Zach Gelb Show right here on CBS Sports Radio. It all gets started at 6 Eastern, 3 Pacific. I'd like to thank our update anchors and Ack, and also Jay Berman, and the great Mike Biseglia, Mikey B, and Tom DiBenedetto as well. Gresh, coming up next, right here on CBS Sports Radio. We'll talk to you tomorrow, everybody. I'm Zach Gelb. I'm out. Peace.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.